I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Paul C. from Escondido.
Good evening. My name's Paul, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Paul.
For some reason, the clock is behind me, so I will use my cell phone here from time to time for your protection. And I want to especially welcome those new members of Alcoholics Anonymous who are here today, and the visitors and the first-timers and so forth. It is my hope that you will find in the fellowship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous what I have found. And I also want to congratulate this woman who got her 60 days. That's terrific. There she is. And then, do I understand it was Roger who got 90 days? Is that correct? Okay. And Perry, who got 6 years? Remarkable. Okay. So, it's so fun to talk after Joan. I can't tell you how much fun that is for me. But we do this. We play tag team, and she'll haul me. The last time she hauled me up to Orange County, made me the 10-minute speaker. So I thought turnabout is fair play, right? So I joined Alcoholics Anonymous the way it was described by the spiritual mentor of our co-founder when he said, if I ever get into heaven, it'll be by backing away from hell. I wasn't so much running forward to embrace sobriety as I was running away from my alcoholism, or more accurately, I was running away from the pain that I somehow vaguely associated with my use of alcohol. That pain was well reflected in the rotten things people said to me during my drinking days. People used to say things like, Paul, you're fired. They said, you're under arrest. You're under arrest again. You're under arrest again. Assume the position. You know the drill by now. I said, I'm sorry, you... What was that? They said, I'm sorry, you'll have to move out. You can't live here anymore. It was my mother who said that. Just wait, kid. Just wait. No, she's an impossibly cute little girl, and I'm so thrilled she's here, really. So they said, do you remember what you said to me last night? Do you know what you did to me last night? Leave my daughter alone. And then I think, then I think my favorite was, here's your ring back, it was kind of small anyway. And I'm thinking, geez, is she talking about the diamond? I hope she's talking about the diamond. Oh, anyway, so people said terrible things to me during my drinking days, but they were really no worse than the things I said to myself. And the things I said to myself were, I'm the worst son, brother, friend, boyfriend, student, employee, citizen, or human being who ever walked the face of the earth. Why don't I just do everyone a favor and kill myself? And it almost came to that before I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a teenage alcoholic. I know that's redundant for some of you tonight. I get a good sense of my progression of my alcoholism by looking at my high school yearbook photo. In it, I see that in the 10th grade, I was involved in a certain number of activities, in 11th grade, fewer, and in 12th grade, fewer yet, and that perfectly paralleled my descent into alcoholism. I was not voted most likely to succeed or best all-around personality. I was voted most stubborn in my high school class. Most of the kids had some kind of a nickname under their names. In my school, it was usually Skip or Muffin or something like that. This is white bread community, right? So, because of some alcohol-related arrests as a youth, my nickname was Jailbird. Most of the kids also had a quote under their name, something you could look back at fondly years later and say, ah, yes, that reminds me of my good friend, what's his name. The girls were in their maudlin phase, so they liked a few lines from a dead poet, preferably one who committed suicide, Sylvia Plath or Anne Sexton or one of them. Boys were in their rebellious phase, so we liked these obscure references to drugs in rock lyrics. But no, my quote was, let's split another six-pack, Dave. So if you look at my high school yearbook and you think, gee, this is a kid who drank a lot, he had problems with authority, stubborn, gee whiz, you'd be right. That's exactly how it was for me when I was in high school, when my alcoholism was gaining speed. I remember one time going to see our family physician when I was a teenager for some real or imagined ailment. I was loaded at the time. I'm in his examination room. He has me in a little chair. I fall off the chair. This is alarming to a physician. And so he leaned over and he says, Paul, are you still drinking and taking drugs? And I said, no, doc, I'm not. And he said, well, you better quit. And I gave him the perfect alcoholic response, which was, okay. Now, I did not quit, of course. Then there was the time I got arrested for being drunk in church during Mass. This is called disturbing a religious ceremony and public intoxication. Now, I knew I was going straight to hell for that. I was hoping maybe I could get a meeting with the DA and the bishop and maybe plea bargain it down to purgatory or something like that. No such luck. So, you know, it was years later, a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous at a meeting shared that she had been kicked out of several churches because of her drinking, which is kind of sad when you think about it. And finally, her alcoholism progressed to the point where she was actually excommunicated from a satanic cult. Now, you know, when that happens, there's really no place left to go but Alcoholics Anonymous, is there? The cult won't have me. Will you guys take me? And the answer is, yes, we will. We will take you. And then one fine fall day, I was indicted by a grand jury, and things went downhill from there. I was arrested in my mother's home. Got a picture of myself in handcuffs on the front page of the local newspaper, and was eventually sent to jail for several months for being a careless drug dealer. Evidently, it's illegal to give LSD to undercover narcotics detectives. So they frown on that, and they threw me in jail for several months. I didn't like being in jail. These guys were all into being, macho and tough and working out, becoming muscle-bound, swearing, smoking cigarettes, having tattoos. Some of their tattoos were misspelled, and they sure appreciated it when I pointed that out to them. Excuse me, aren't there two L's in killer, Jails are filled with violent and impulsive criminals who will hit you with a little provocation. So that's what happened. So one day, a guy in a cell next to me was going someplace else in the jail, and I said, where are you going? He says, I'm going to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I said, sign me up. And he did. And I hope I never forget that I attended my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting with the pristine motive, deeply spiritual and self-actualizing purpose of getting out of my cell block. As far as I'm concerned, that's as good a reason anybody ever needs to attend an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. We have empty chairs here tonight that could be filled with drunks. There are people within two blocks of this church who have never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, or what's worse, what they have heard makes them not want to join. We've got a lot of work to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't we? So this was a small, rural, upstate New York county jail. They didn't have a well-organized correctional facilities committee or institutional committee. They waited till they had a critical mass of drunks in the jail. Then I called up Roger, a local AA member, and asked him to come in and put on a meeting. I happened to be there during one such critical mass of drunks. Roger was an old guy. He was about 37 years old. And I remember a couple of things he said early on. He said, Alcoholics Anonymous is not connected, we're not affiliated with the church, with the criminal justice system, or professional psychological treatment, three institutions with which I had had considerable trouble in the past myself. He also said, we didn't make Alcoholics Anonymous or the steps so hard that a drunk couldn't do it, or none of us would be here, right? So I remember that to this day. And at one time, at one of the meetings, Roger brought in an outside speaker who was a guy on parole. And this guy said he used to go into the store to get a six-pack of beer, and by the time he got to the checkout counter, there were only five left. And I thought, these guys drink like I do. These guys drink like I do. I was 19 years old. I got out of jail, started smoking hash and drinking beer, and ran away to California, which was wonderful. The only problem was I brought myself with me. And you know what I drank? I drank Valley High, Spaniata, Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill, Annie Green Springs, and Ripple. None of these have ever been close to a grape at all, right? And I have never used a corkscrew in my entire life, okay? That tells you what kind of a highfalutin drunk I was. But I'll tell you, when the fear and the loneliness and the depression and the drinking got bad enough, I thought about Roger. And I went over, they used to have these things called phone booths. And I went to a phone booth and called Alcoholics Anonymous. And they directed me to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, which I went to. And I was received well at the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. This was in the early 70s. I had hair to my shoulders, a beard, more jeans and sandals, and an Air Force jacket I got for a few bucks at a thrift store. I was also angry, and it showed. One guy came up to me, Bob Kay, used to be the custodian there. You remember Bob? Yeah, so Bob came up to me, and Bob was an immensely popular fellow, and people would come up to him, and he'd say, wait, I want you to meet Paul. He's the new man. And I went from being the town drunk to being the new man simply by showing up at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. These people could not have cared less about my politics, my religion, my job. I was unemployed, of course. My sexual orientation, my last name, or my other problems and addictions, of which I had many. I could have had two heads, and they would have said, well, this one's going to need two cups of coffee. And that would have been about the end of it, really. After the meeting, another guy came up to me. I didn't know it then, but he had been sober 9 months after 9 years of bouncing in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, dropping acid and smoking pot. He took one look at me, which was probably a tip-off, and said, "What else are you on?" "What do you mean?" I said innocently. He said, "LSD, pot, speed, reds, whites, mescaline, what else are you taking?" And I said, "All of the above." And he says, "Well, you better knock it off or you're not going to make it." And I was offended by that because I thought, here I was being a good guy by giving up alcohol, and you people want me to give up my other hobbies too. I did not immediately comply. I came to a couple AA meetings after smoking pot. This is a bad idea. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to assure you, you do not have to smoke pot to be paranoid at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. You just show up and we'll do the rest. So, at the time, I was living in an apartment building that was filled with young men, and all we did is drink as much as we could all day and take as many drugs as we could all day. There were a couple guys who would sit in a corner, smoke pot, and play chess. Do you know how pot smokers play chess? They stare at the chessboard for 45 minutes, and then one of them says, "Whose turn is it?" So I stopped smoking pot and going to AA meeting. Then I ate a couple bottles of over-the-counter sleeping tablets and a half-hearted suicide attempt, and without belaboring the obvious, it didn't work. But it does work around here all the time, doesn't it? We just never know. You just never know. And then I got sick, and I needed some cough syrup. And just so there's no mistake about the active ingredient in this brand of cough syrup, they put a plastic shot glass on top of the bottle. Right? If one's good, two's better. If two's better, you might as well drink the whole bottle, which is exactly what I did. So people were, and I'm continuing going to AA meetings at the time. People are saying crazy things at AA meetings. They're saying things like, "We don't smoke pot here." I said, "What do you mean you don't smoke pot? Everybody smokes pot." They said, "No, Paul, everybody you know smokes pot. That's part of the problem." They'd say things like, "NyQuil is not an after-dinner drink for most of us." So, okay, so I felt like I had to change my sobriety date, which I did not want to do because I didn't want to give up my 10 weeks of accumulated sobriety that I had. But I did it anyway. I stood up at a meeting probably not too different from this and said, "Listen, I'm changing my sobriety date from this date to that because of this." Did they recoil in horror? Of course not. They were too busy thinking about what they would say if they got called on. But I'll tell you, if I hadn't done that, you'd have a different speaker here tonight. If I couldn't be honest about the basic reason why I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, how could I be honest about the other, the terrible things I'd done, terrible things I'd felt? By the way, I wasn't really that good at being bad, but when I came into AA, I was just lower than a snake's belly or whatever that metaphor is. So I got a sponsor within a couple weeks of joining Alcoholics Anonymous. Not within a couple months, not within a couple years, and not the perfect guy. My criteria for getting a sponsor were pretty simple. He has time for me, and he cares whether I live or die. That was it. And he took me to a meeting place in San Diego, And he parked about two blocks away from the meeting hall. I said, well, there's some parking space right out front. Why didn't you park there? He says, I realize that. He says, but there's elderly people who come to this meeting. You'll see them showing up pretty soon with their canes and walkers. They're the ones that need to park close. We're the lucky ones. We're young. We can walk. And I have never forgotten, obviously, that simple expression of humanity and humility that I see every day in Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, we got our big shots. We got our loud mouths. Those are not the ones I pay attention to. I pay attention to the ones who quiet, humble, get the job done. That's what I like in Alcoholics Anonymous. Other people can like that other stuff if they want to. Okay. My sponsor took me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I just give you a couple examples of how I was at the time. I said, I can't write an inventory. I can't write a list of resentments. I hate everybody in the world. He said, Paul, there's 4 billion people in the world. You better get started. One time he handed me a phone book and said, here, they're alphabetical for you. I feel sorry for the newcomers today because now there's about 7.5 or 8 billion people in the world. So, okay, so I did that, and I wrote down my resentments and faults and fears and sexual misconduct and had them down to my place. My place, by the way, was a single-room occupancy hotel in downtown San Diego above the burned-out blood bank in the room next to where the FBI had arrested a bank robber when I checked in. By the way, when the blood bank moves out of town, property values are not going up, okay? So Jerry came down, and he sat there. Sometimes I could look him right in the eye as I told him something particularly embarrassing and humiliating, and other times all I could do was read the words off the page. And when I got done with my fifth step, I didn't feel like I was walking hand in hand down the broad highway with the spirit of the universe. But I did know that I had been honest with another person for the first time in my life. And I was so grateful for that. And then later on, of course, we had to make amends. And I'm the kind of guy, I could feel guilty forever over dipping a girl's pigtail in an inkwell in third grade. But some woman I was in a 3-year relationship with whose feelings I just steamrolled over, after careful consideration, I really think she deserved everything she got. So I had absolutely no perspective on this stuff at all. After meeting with my sponsor, he says, you know, Paul, you probably don't have to hire a private detective to find that little girl from third grade, but you may want to have a conversation, for example, with your mother. Oh, really? Okay. So I went back to my hometown, and I met with my mother, and I met with my stepfather, and I met with my grandfather, and my older brother, and my younger brother, and my ex-girlfriend, and her parents, and the neighbors. And I also went up to the rectory of the church. Hello, Father, are you in there? Can we talk? You have to do that stuff. I had to do that stuff to stay. And when I got done, as much as one can, with those amends, I was free. I'm not, and that remains to this day. Oh, I goof up from time to time and still have to repair things. But I'm not afraid to open my door, open my mailbox, open my mail, answer the phone. I'm not worried about what's going. I don't care if the police pull me over. I have a driver's license. I have a registered vehicle. I have automobile insurance. No warrants. I mean, it's a whole new world. I encourage new people to try that. It's actually a whole new world. And so I'm very, very grateful for that. Now, I probably need to Yeah, I need to tell you that I did have some problems with women in my life. I know this is hard to believe, but when I was sober a year, I was in lust with the heroin addict who lived next door. And she wouldn't have anything to do with me. If that tells you what kind of a prize I was at a year sober, right? And then I fell in love with a wonderful woman. And she was just, we had a great relationship. And then that didn't work out. So, okay. So then I decided to move an ex-girlfriend across country from Philadelphia in with me. I was sober 2 years and had not seen her in 4 years. So I moved her cross country and moved her in with me, sight unseen. Yeah, like you've never done stuff like that. So you had a great relationship for about 20 minutes. And then she started doing things without my permission. She smoked pot without my permission. She'd have sex with other men without my permission. She had sex with other women without my permission. Look, if you're going to have sex with other women, the least you can do is invite me along, you know. Can't believe he said that. Yeah. She moved out without my permission. She got an abortion without my permission. Certainly her perfect right. I was attending the University of California at the time. They're on 10-week quarters. I spent 6 weeks at home in my bathrobe depressed. And you know what saved me? Was sponsorship. Not my sponsor, who was far too busy helping other men, but the men I sponsored. I still remember Mark, who was sober about 6 months, would come over every night and he would say this. He'd say, "Come on, Paul, get dressed. It's time to go to a meeting. Remember when you used to tell me that?" And he dragged his sorry ass sponsor around until I got my head out of where it didn't belong to begin with. And there's no question in my life that Mark saved my life with that. A few years later, he officiated at the wedding of me and my wife. So there's that. I was also afraid that I could never get any kind of a good job because of my record. And when I was sober about 4.5 years, I applied for a non-sworn position with a law enforcement agency doing research. And when you do that, there's a background check and a polygraph exam and references and so forth. And I was open and honest about my arrests and convictions and about my recovery, and I got the job. And that taught me some very important things. It taught me that the world is more forgiving of me than I am of it. And people are more forgiving of me than I am of myself. Okay? I've had certain involvements with legal things at official turning points in my life. It doesn't matter. As long as I'm honest about that. One time, Little League, had to go through a background check. Fine. Cub Scout leader, had to go through a background check. When you move to Boy Scouts, you have to do it again. And one of the gals came up to me and said, "Well, Paul, I want you to fill this application out, but can you leave this stuff off?" I said, "Why would I do that?" She said, "Well, we had a hell of a time getting you approved as a Cub Scout leader." I said, "Well, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to leave anything off, because, by the way, if you do that, it's going to come around and bite you in the ass later, and who needs that?" And I said, "If they won't approve me as a Boy Scout leader, I'll litigate it as a hobby." And that was a not very veiled threat, and I never heard another one. When I got my professional license, I looked at that. I had to fill it, I looked at it. And it asks about arrests and convictions. And I'm thinking, all this years of schooling down the drain? I filled it out, never heard another word about it. When we adopted our son, same thing, never heard another word about it. when the firm I was in was being acquired. The key management personnel, of whom I was one, had to sit down with the lawyers and tell. And I went into the president of the company and I told him, I said, look, I got this, 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 and this happening. He says, Paul, no one cares. I don't care. The attorneys won't care. Nobody cares. If you want to tell them, go ahead and tell them. I did tell them. And you know what? They didn't care. So I got to tell you this story. My wife and I had been married 10 years. My wife comes from a large, loving family, okay? I, too, come from a family. And we wanted to adopt a child. We could not have children. So we went to the adoption agency and had the classes and the counseling and the background checks and so forth, and we were put on a waiting list. And when you're on an adoption waiting list, you wait. And it was at the wedding of some AA friends that we first heard about Nancy. Nancy was a divorced mother of three, pregnant 5 months, sober 5 years, and was considering surrendering her baby for adoption. We made arrangements to meet, realized we knew each other, not well, but peripherally through AA. She came over to our place, and she was already signed up with an adoption agent. She decided to switch her agency to our agency, which was County Adoptions, because it was important to her that her baby be raised in the home where the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous were at least attempted. Kevin was born on March 12th, 1990. Mary woke up that morning, my wife Mary woke up that morning and said, Kevin's been born, and called the hospital, and indeed he was. March 12th was my stepfather's 75th birthday. It was also the birthday of the social worker who helped us get him. Nancy took him home for a few weeks and then brought him to us, and a number of months later we're all in court to finalize the adoption. And in the hallway before we went into court, Nancy gave Kevin the 5-year token that his birth father, who is also in AA, gave her the previous year, and she also gave him a note. And here's what the note said. November 9th, 1990. Dear Kevin, this token is for you. I wore it on my keychain while I was pregnant with you. We made it through my 5th year of sobriety, healthy and sober, and so you are a healthy baby. God bless you and your new mommy and daddy on this special day. I love you with all my heart, and I always will, your birth mother, Nancy. This on the day her parental rights were terminated and ours began. Now what? Oh.
Just in case you need that.
Oh, okay. So, Nancy has since gone on to marry a fine gentleman. They had another baby, baby Renee, and when the kids were growing up, we got together for birthdays and holidays and celebrations, and if I wrote a script, and I wrote a lot of them in my head, it couldn't have turned out better. I'm so grateful. So, as a matter of fact, tomorrow I'm going to a party at Nancy's place. So, one time when Kevin was about 2 or 3, Mary took him to a local kid's birthday party. So they sing happy birthday to the kid. Happy birthday, dear Johnny. Happy birthday to you. One lone voice in the back says, keep coming back, it works. Right? When he was a little portable guy, we took him to AA meetings. After he knew what people were talking about, we stopped taking him to AA meetings. Right? And then when he was in preschool, I went to a Father's Day preschool luncheon. Three fathers, happened to be three little boys, sitting at a tiny table, eating a tiny lunch, and sitting in tiny chairs. One of the boys said, "My daddy's a police officer." The other little boy says, "Yeah, well, my daddy's a football player." Kevin proudly drew himself up to his full 3 foot height and said, "Yeah, well, my daddy is an alcoholic." Now, I fell off the chair laughing. Fortunately, it was just a little preschool chair, so I didn't get hurt. So Kevin didn't know what he was saying, but he knew something about that was important to Daddy. And he was absolutely right. He's 29 years old now. He lives up in the Hollywood area. When you look out his porch, you can see the Hollywood sign. He's living with his beautiful film actress girlfriend. Where did I go wrong? Where did I go wrong? A friend of mine says, "Where should I start?" But she got a TV series got picked up recently. So we got married. I got to go down to Comic-Con. And I've never seen so many Supermen and Wonder Women and Batmen and so on in my life. So they brought her down to Comic-Con so she could have a panel about the show and an autograph session. And then we got VIP seats at the world premiere of the show and got to go to a very nice reception afterwards. We had taken the train down from Oceanside, and when we're done, they Ubered us home. So, I mean, this is the kind of kid I've got. He is so much fun. We've had so much fun with him over the years. I can't believe it. I just can't believe it. Now, I hope it's as clear to you as it's clear to me that everything that's important to me in my life, my health, such as it is, my spirituality, my family relationships, my relationships with all the wonderful people in Alcoholics Anonymous, all of that is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't want there to be any mistake about that. Coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, associating with the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, paying attention to the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, is the only way any of this could have happened. I neglected to mention, and I probably should, my sobriety date is January 15th, 1974. I was 21 years old at the time. I just turned 67. I'm very grateful to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you very much.